Hi, my name is Martin Purnell and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity Podcast, a weekly podcast for people who feel disconnected from church. On today's Off-Grid Christianity, Frog Orr Ewing joins me to discuss his life to date, which involves being a conservationist, ordained priest and a lecturer at Winchester University. He also is a pastor and rector of Latimer Minster. More about that in a few minutes. Frog, thanks for joining us today. I was going to ask you where you got the name Frog, but instead I'll turn it around. How many people these days actually call you by your real name, which is Francis?
Not many, if truth be told. A few kind of grandparents and others, but they've gone to a better place now. So I think not many. A bank manager or two, I think.
Because I often wonder, you know, Bono from U2, you know, I wonder how many people call him Paul, you know, maybe just his wife or something, I don't know. But so what is Amy,
when
your
he's
wife
done something
you?
Naughty?
Yeah, Paul, come
she
here.
She calls me Frog. Frog, darling, you know, the normal.
And Dad from your kids. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk more about later on about Latimer Minster, which I'm very interested to hear indeed. But before we do that, it's our regular opportunity to ask you five questions. If that's okay, so we can get a better opinion of who you really are. So if you're ready, good sir. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, that is, so you could sit them down and ask questions, who would it be?
I think I'd be fascinated to talk to Tolkien or C.S. Lewis, some of the Inklings, sitting down with them.
Yeah.
They seem to be quite keen to sit down with a pint. The Eagle and Child, or the Bird and Babe as it was called, which used to back onto my room when I was an undergraduate at Oxford.
Oh, wow.
And I was always thinking about it, went down and had a couple of celebratory half pints or so of my own just to just be excited about that idea of changing culture and forming culture whilst being a Christian. And that life of the mind, as well as the life of the kind of the soul and the arts all combined together, and just seeing their extraordinary legacy. I think I'd like to kind of have him around the table and allow him to light his pipe and have a chat and see what made him tick. And I particularly would ask him, I think, some slightly random questions. My favourite book of his is That Hideous Strength, out of the science fiction trilogy. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of foresaw post-modernity, really, a kind of funny mix of science and mysticism joined together in a university town. I thought that was really insightful, so I'd love to ask him about that.
Excellent. Well, if you ever come over to Belfast, at the bottom of one of the main roads, Newton Isles Road, there's a statue of C.S. Lewis looking at the certain wardrobe. And at the back of the wardrobe is the letter that he wrote to a little girl explaining who and what is Narnia all about. It is a fantastic, almost like real-life sculpture. It's brilliant. Thank you. Good choice.
I went to see it, actually.
I've seen it.
Went to see it a few months ago. Yes, it's a superb sculpture. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And the person who does the sculpture lives just around the corner from us. So, yes, fantastic. Question number two. Who is your favourite biblical character, or favourite biblical story, or favourite parable?
I think I have a favourite at one time or other, rather than an all-time favourite.
Yeah.
I do find Abraham really intriguing at the moment. I spent a long time really thinking about him during lockdown, him and his ministry and his life. And I found him utterly fascinating at the moment. And also in terms of parables, I think I love the parables of the wheat and the tares. Just there's so many layers of complexity. Mm. I mean, I could choose pretty much any parable. I just find them absolutely brilliant. So,
do you know, wheat and tares, I was talking that to a fellow friend, a vicar friend of mine, who actually went to theological college with you all those years ago. And he actually explained me the difference between the wheat and the tares. And apparently a tare, certainly in biblical times, looked like a piece of wheat growing up. Am I right on that? Oh, it's difficult to...
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely it's sometimes hard to translate the Greek words into like the exact equivalents, but there's definitely a kind of thing that looks very similar.
Yeah, yeah. Good one, thank you. Now, here we go. Are you going to go serious or are you going to be slightly sarcastic on this one? If you're Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
I think I would want people to be able to give away more to people, and particularly towards the end of their life, if they wanted to give away things to different people, churches, and or even to their family and relatives, I'd like them to be able to do that without feeling like they've got to last 7 years or so. I see just in the press today, that's one on the top of my mind. That'd be lovely, wouldn't it, to feel like you could give away a huge amount in the last 2 years of your life and not be worried about how that was going to play out with paperwork.
Yes.
So I think that would allow people to feel such a greater sense of enthusiasm and joy towards the end of life. They've got something to give away and something to pass on to the next generation. I would love to see that happen.
That's a great answer. That's great. Well, you never know. You might become Prime Minister one day, in which case we'll look forward to seeing that one.
Highly, highly unlikely. Exactly.
Well, I don't know. I got confused between a conservationist and a conservative, so you never know. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
I do love mountains, and I really could pick a number of days on the top of snow-filled mountains as just being amazing. I think a favourite place that I've been to is between France and Italy. There's a St Bernard Pass there, and just being at the top there and seeing this gap between the Alps covered in snow, I think that was just a beautiful day out, one I'd love to do again.
Sounds great. And finally, what has been, to date, your most embarrassing moment?
I think it happened quite early on in my childhood, if I think about it. I was, I think, fairly distracted at school one day, and we went in the swimming pool to do a couple of lengths in the school swimming pool during a swimming lesson. And I got halfway down the length and one of my friends shouted out to me from the sort of following lane that I'd forgot to put my swimming trunks on. And I'd completely forgotten. And so to this day, that feeling of horror of like, how could I have just come through the changing rooms and neglected such an important point still stays with me to this day as possibly one of the most embarrassing moments of my life.
That is a cracker, mine. That is an absolute cracker. Well, thank you for sharing that. And obviously, right at the very beginning, I asked how many people call you Francis instead of Frog. And I take it Frog was most probably a name given to you as a kid growing up from relatives or whatever. True or false?
Yeah, I think, yeah. So when I was probably just in my a few months old, really, maybe not even a year, it seems to have emerged as the Froglet. And then when I was about just amongst some family members, and then when I was 10, I decided that because I had hit double figures, it was time to grow up. And tadpoles became froglets, and I'd learned enough about metamorphosis to know that by the age of 10, surely I was now worthy of the name Frog rather than Froglet. So I named myself Frog by that stage instead of Froglet, and has stuck with it ever since. And it's never really gone away, I think.
No.
It's one of those words that works in any language. I think of times that I've spent on mission trips and meeting other Christian leaders and believers in parts of the world like Uganda. And great fun has always had trying to work out what my name would be in all these other different languages. And it's I think it's great to have a name that's instantly translatable.
Yes. That's brilliant. And obviously, it's not a rude name either. So it's something you don't mind wearing the badge for, which is great. This is great for you to join us today. And obviously, your wife, Amy Orr Ewing, if people like me read a certain Bible series for notes, she writes regularly for that as well. How did you two meet?
We met at the end of our first term at university. We were both studying at the same university, and we met really planning a mission trip to China the following summer. Both of us had this idea that we'd like a trip with a few undergraduates to go to China the following summer. And we met sort of through mutual friends and friends of friends at a prayer meeting at our first term at university.
And started from there. Wow.
Yeah. And I planned that trip, and a few months into planning the trip, I realized that I couldn't really think straight when she was in the room. That was the giveaway for me. And I think that was maybe February of our first year at uni. And then we started going out then, and we got engaged the following year and got married 3 weeks after finals.
Wow. What was she studying at university, and what were you studying?
I was studying theology, and she was studying pure Hebrew, and then switched, downgraded to theology for pure Hebrew at the end of her first year.
To be with you, no doubt.
No, I wish, I wish. No, she's always had the edge, I think.
It was a fascinating story of you going to Afghanistan with some of your mates and Amy as well. You mentioned Uganda. What other countries have you visited?
It's been a bit of a theme since we met of really enjoying the relationship of going to other parts of the world, both together and as part of wider teams. And so I think for me, a number of countries, Africa, Uganda and Kenya and Nigeria and Ghana, countries like that, and South Africa have been really important to us. But Amy has traveled a lot more than me, I would say. Over the last 20 years or so, is usually has been outside of the country, maybe once or twice a month, different parts of the world. So she's traveled a lot more widely than I have. For me, it's mostly bits of Europe, America, and parts of Africa that have really, really been where I've got excited. And then obviously one's gone to different places for holiday with family.
Yeah. A friend of mine once said, actually, that the way he sees God working in his life is that what you've done in the past 20 years normally gives you an understanding of what God might want to use you for the next 20 years. And the fact you mentioned Africa quite a few times now, you know, how do you think you might be involved with Africa in the years to come?
I think we're in this really fascinating moment in the global church, if I'm honest, of just seeing that process of God's people moving around the world. And I think a key part of seeing how Africa is going to play out will be seeing how Africa is at work within the UK and Europe, really, in terms of diaspora communities, and just seeing that interplay. These are not completely separate categories, really. Sort of Europe and Africa are not separate categories anymore. And so I think that'll be a big part of it, really. To what extent does the African church and African Christians begin to set the tone of what's going to happen in the UK and other parts of Europe over the next decade or so? So really, I would love to just be part of a conduit, I suppose, just still part of that relationship, keeping those relationships going and going well. And that really applies across all kinds of different flavours of Christianity, as to what that's going to look like. So I think it'll be a question of what does it look like when the diaspora is no longer a diaspora, but really a fully integrated part, and know their sort of stakeholding within Britain. And how do we, as potentially, if I'm an Anglo-Saxon, but how do we respond to African leadership within the West? Yeah. I think is going to be a fascinating thing that I'm looking to explore and support, I suppose, over the next few years as an academic, as well as hopefully continuing to work with African church leaders in the West.
Well, talking as an academic then, What are the main differences have you found between, say, being a Christian in an African church and being a Christian, say, in London, Glasgow, Paris, Munich, sort of thing?
These are enormous categories, obviously, but I think you've got a kind of urban and rural play out that's really important. I think, for example, an urban Nigerian from Lagos, then living and working in the heart of London or an urban capital, may well have a lot more in common than even a rural community in Nigeria and a Lagos community in Nigeria. Does that make sense? That kind of urban and rural dynamic is really, really big. It's possibly as large as Africa and Europe. So with that sort of caveat in mind, I would say there's a kind of many African churches meeting in the UK would really emphasize prayer and worship and their relationship with God as being part of 7 days a week, integrated right the way through, part of their work life and their home life as well as their church life, in a way that's probably slightly less compartmentalized than many white Western Christians might be living their lives. So I think that's one difference. I think there's also a difference in many cultures to do with the role of authority and how that plays out. Freedom and authority is very, very, very different. I mean, I suppose the more I think about it, the more I think there's just a huge amount of difference. I think the African churches, many African church leaders, particularly in the Anglican sort of communion, have felt it's been an important part of their role in the last few years to remind the Western church of their of the core values that they have held to that were sort of exported. And one of those would be the reliability of the scriptures and the importance of the gospel being something reliable and shareable, and a willingness, I think, to count the cost in your own personal life in terms of suffering, and spent a lot of time in relationship with Christian believers in Northern Nigeria or in Plateau State in the middle part. And just realizing the cost of discipleship in many parts of the world that are facing violence. And I would love to see that boldness and courage really retained and shared with the British church, I think, to keep us alert to the cost of discipleship in the UK situation.
Yeah, I mean, you often hear, well, occasionally you'll hear people saying, oh, they're seeing real miracles happen in Africa because they actually believe that, you know, if you ask for a miracle, Jesus will come and will do something. What have you seen when you were over there regarding miracles, modern day miracles?
I think probably similar to what I've seen happen in the UK. I'm not sure I would necessarily draw a big contrast between one and the other, but it has been wonderful to pray for people and see healing, and to see people struggling with lameness or blindness, finding that they are no longer struggling those things after they've been prayed for. So those are a few things that stand out to me. And I think also in terms of mental struggle, I think it's really important to believe that God is able to work with us in a holistic way. And so to have an understanding maybe of healing that includes the emotions as well as the spiritual and the physical, and really to be looking for healing in a number of those different areas rather than privileging one type of miracle, suppose, over and above another. I always find that moment when somebody decides to follow Christ for the first time, whatever their circumstances, to be a beautiful moment of personal miracle, really. So I think that still remains the thing I love to see the most, whether that's here in the UK or whether it's in parts of the world, Uganda.
Obviously, it says in some of your blurb that, you know, you're a pastor, and I can hear from what you're sharing, and just, you know, how much you want to share the love of Jesus and praying for people and things like that. I think what I'd like to do really is just go straight for it now and talk about Latimer Minster. Latimer, where is that, sir? And then tell us how you got involved, please.
Yeah, so we're on the outskirts of London, halfway between Oxford and London, just by the edge of the M25, which is the Ring Road. And really started as a community when we were in, we had relationships and ministry that we were doing in Oxford, and we also involved in Peckham, Southeast London, centre of London, and really starting to pray together as a couple about what would come next. And I think the third question, apart from geography, was this question of what kinds of Christian communities would we like to see start to develop for the next generation, and people who were wanting a connection with the environment and the outdoors, people who are part of a digital culture, and young adults, I think, who had felt really estranged from institutional Christianity. So that was the kind of idea core, and this ancient Christian idea of a minster that had really come up from my studying of early Western Christianity and the sort of missionary movement of the Celtic Christians and early Northern Europe from about 400 to about 800 AD. Those 400 years were the heyday of the minster. And this idea started to brew through, I think, a process of reflection and also a theological study. And then I think, prayer and even dreams and things like that that come out in your prayer life started to coalesce with this very strong burden, I think, to see what would it look like to start a minster, a missionary monastic community on the edge of London, halfway between Oxford and London, that would serve other churches as well as start other churches, as well as being a Christian community all of its own. So, I mean, in a sense, we felt we didn't have a enormously clear blueprint to start off with. We had sort of threads that we were trying to work with. So that was back in 2010. And so we left our church in Peckham and moved out here with a small group of people in 2010.
Excuse my ignorance, but what exactly does minster mean?
Well, it's a shortened English word from the Latin. They think English people have never been very good at foreign languages. And so it's kind of an elision of this idea of a monasterium, and they kind of just shortened it to minster. Oh, okay. So you still see it around in places like Westminster,
yes,
for example.
York Minster.
So you see York Minster. So you, and so they were kind of missionary monastic hubs, really. A number of places like that in Wales that would start with the word chlan, for example, that kind of a place, a sacred place. And so you still see little pockets of these names and these words around the country, but essentially they were a missionary monastic community who worshipped and prayed and studied together and used to go to the surrounding regions and neighbourhoods and preach the gospel. And little smaller churches would bubble up, is the idea, around those villages and communities, and essentially would plant what we now know as parish churches, more local expressions, would be planted out of those. And so even that word parish comes from the Latin parochiae, which actually just means an area of influence, and first was described the minsters, not the local churches, interestingly. So that's where the word actually began, to describe how do Christian communities exercise their ministry across an area or across some relationships. And they would say, well, the sphere of influence is a parochiae or a parish. So that was obviously a very long time ago that those terms were coined.
But we're still here today, parochial and council, don't we?
Yeah, and it's kind of flipped it round, I suppose. Mm. So the idea was that the original parishes were kind of not actual geographical boundaries at all. They were a bit more malleable at the edges and a lot more relational and spiritual, to do with spiritual relationships and influence that obviously also had some geographic connection to them. But around about 1100, it flipped when Well, it's often to do with taxes when things get nailed down, and it was also in those days too. So around sort of 1100, when people are wanting to have taxes paid, they decided to kind of nail these parishes down and turn them into taxable units, rather than sort of ministry units. So yeah, and that's then how the sort of more localized and formalized understanding of parish becomes the sort of the more normal understanding of what's going on.
Got you. So you mentioned Celtic Christianity earlier on. That's a word, Celtic Christianity, or two words, should I say, that's bandied around quite a lot these days. You can go to Iona and find out more about it there. But to you, what if you had to sum up what Celtic Christianity was and what you think Celtic Christianity is now, what would you say?
I mean, historically, it was just early Christians in this part of the world, I would say, in Northern Europe. It just described the form of Christian community that flourished and tended to really grow along coastlines. And so you would end up around Scotland and Ireland, particularly a big community in Ireland, and then down to Cornwall, which now seem as if they're very far apart. But in those days, where the boats were the highways, not the roads, they were actually quite closely connected together. So as those Christian communities started to bubble up, that the form of Christianity which they had then became known as Celtic Christianity. And then you get a kind of Roman form of Christianity that sort of moves up from Kent rather than down from Ireland. Around about, you know, Augustine of Canterbury, who becomes sort of a key part of that, and the sort of tail ends of the Roman Empire, they start to overlap with each other. So there's a certain extent to which we're just talking about phases of history and different groups and the way that they did their Christianity. And I think to modern day ears, though, when people are trying to talk about Celtic Christianity, they tend to mean a few things. They tend to mean an emphasis on being probably led by the spirit and influenced by the seasons over and above institutional forms. There tends to be an interest in spirituality and liturgy and even new forms of monasticism. And what does it mean to live and function and exist as a Christian or an artistic community? And I think it's become a place that people have wanted to explore within sort of British DNA, I suppose, of like what would an authentic version of British spirituality be that's not so influenced by colonialism, empire, or institutionalism? And so I think quite often in history people go back, you know, are there moments in our own history that can perhaps give us clues to avenues for the future? And that's actually quite a British thing to do, to try to look for clues to the future in our past. Culturally, we tend to enjoy doing that in ways that maybe other nations or cultures don't seem to be so interested in. But I think this idea of going back to one's roots in order to potentially renew at times of flux and intellectual and cultural uncertainty, I think a lot of people are saying, well, you know, where are there forms of Christianity that were at work within the British Isles that I feel excited about, because I'm not that excited about other things? So is there a safe way of being a Christian for our modern era? I think, I mean, one of the biggest challenges to it is that therefore there's a kind of romanticism, I think, about the idea of Celtic Christianity, which some people enjoy. And I think the second thing is, you know, there is a huge difference between the Celtic setup in sort of 400, 500 AD and our current modern era. There's potentially more change between those than anything else. But I think missiologists were really wrestling with these two ideas, these two concepts of Celtic and Roman church and how they kind of clashed and vied for legitimacy and ways of being. And then I think people reading through more modern church history would say, well, perhaps we need to recognize that there are kind of static and more institutional and localized forms of faith and church. But then they've always been these kind of slightly less hard to pin down movements going on as well. So whether that's the Methodists with their circuits, or whether it was the mission agencies of the 1890s and the early 1900s who were, you know, forming networks in the UK and then planting churches all across the world and doing it just as a group of volunteers without any state funding. And this volunteerism, and I think that loose as a goose, and that sense of how do we follow the flow of the Spirit and enjoy the liberty of being Christians rather than feeling constrained by institutionalism. And I think these cultural moments have happened before, of this kind of tussle between liberty and order. And I think the Celtic Christians are seen as more of the proponents of liberty, I suppose, and the sort of what people see as the Roman or sort of hierarchical model as being more of an emphasis on order and control. Yes. And obviously an ideal scenario would perhaps be a blend of the two. But human nature is a funny thing. To hold all of these things together in tension without having a squabble or a fight seems to be very challenging. But I think many people would admit that would be ideal, is to have both the movemental, spirit-led elements of liberty, but also that sense of safety and order and accountability. And how does one hold both of those in creative, dynamic tension?
Yes.
That, I think, is the ideal. And I think probably when the Lord looks on his church, he sees all of them as being his church anyway. So even if we are in different streams or different bundles or denominations or patterns of spirituality, I think the Lord looks at the whole bunch of us as one, even when we're not, when we're struggling with that.
Yeah, and I get that. You see, my brain works, as my wife will tell anybody, differently to most people, because it's weird at times. And I just had this picture of you and Amy praying, and I've just wandered in for when you were at Peckham. And, you know, you were announcing to your faithful tribe, you know, we're going to go and we're going to go to Latimer. And immediately I was thinking, all right, Andy Latimer, the great guitarist from the prog band Camel, but obviously not that, it's obviously a little place. So why did you choose Latimer? What happened? How did you get to Latimer?
Actually, funnily enough, there is a place called Latimer, but it was actually the person Latimer.
Oh, so I'm almost right then.
He was one of the three people martyred in Oxford, Cranmer, Latimer and Ridley, who were burnt at the stake during the Reformation, the sort of Counter-Reformation under Mary, and burnt in the Broad Street in Oxford. And they famously say, "Be of good cheer, Master Ridley, and play the man, for we shall light such a candle in England by God's grace, this will never be put out." And that's the sort of final words as that he says to Ridley. And then Cranmer, who was one of the great reformers, died a few months later. He was executed a few months later, all on that same spot. So again, in our time that we'd spent in Oxford, we're really struck by that story again and again. And used to meet at the little pile of stones that's still in the middle of Broad Street that marks the very spot to this day, often to sort of talk and pray and discuss the history and the present and the future. And so we also realised that as we were thinking about it, it's the name of a place in Buckinghamshire. Latimer has this location and this hero in Oxford. And then also, if you take the A40 all the way into London, there's a whole area around Latimer Road and Latimer in West London as well, near places like Grenfell Tower, up and down the A40. So we just saw it as a name that linked together really the concept. It was really the person Latimer that drove us the most, and wanting to name a community after that. And so, funnily enough, the logo is those stones.
Got you.
So right away from the beginning.
You then, obviously, you think this idea of getting a minster where you can invite people around if they want to be prayed for, they can be prayed for. If they want to find themselves getting to know Jesus better, they can come to know Jesus better. But obviously, you need a property to do this. So how did you find your property, and describe it to us, please?
Yeah, so it was a bit of a struggle to find a patch of ground, really. And in about 2012, finally, after much negotiation, we found a derelict farm exactly halfway between Oxford and London. And really on the site of a sort of a prayer-filled sketch map I drew in 2010, where X marks the spot.
Oh, wow.
And there this abandoned farm came up for sale. So it took us about 18 months and the help of friends and a mortgage and some inheritance and every little scrap of anything we could find. And we ended up being able to buy this property as a couple in 2012, in fact, 10 years ago. And so that's what it is. We have 70 acres just on the side of the A40, halfway between Oxford and London, on an ancient threshing floor in a farm that's existed for 1,000 years. So wow. that's where the Minster meets when we meet together. And it's a kind of spiritual and physical anchor, really, to quite a slightly more dispersed community. It's not just all about what goes on there, but it feels like a really important anchor and space where we can meet and pray and welcome people.
See, you've obviously been an ordained minister within the Anglican Church. You go to your bishop and you say, I really feel God wants me to do this, and we're going to start a Minster, which, you know, hardly anyone has these days. How encouraging was he? And if it had been me, was he laughing and falling off the chair saying, you've got to be mad, mate?
No, we actually had a lot of very warm support when we moved into the area. And in fact, we floated this idea and one bishop who we'd really shared it with sort of shared the idea with two or three other bishops who sort of met the criteria of being halfway between Oxford and London. And our local one in Buckinghamshire invited us to come and plant. And then we really spent a little while trying to work out what does that mean. How does one do that? How do we square these different pieces of being a missionary monastic community? And how do we work out when we actually have a congregation, which we've had for different times, bigger and smaller ones? There's a constant to-ing and fro-ing about to exactly how to allow models of church and to kind of interact and coalesce. That's still not over. But, you know, as we began, nothing but warmth, really, and a genuine warm invitation, both written and otherwise. And the Bishop of Oxford as well really stood behind us in that. So that's how we founded, really, even though we were just a tiny group of people moving out from the inner city and a few others who grew up in the area, probably only about less than a dozen of us to begin with. We had real warm support and prayer from him and a number of others.
That's great. So if I turned up today, obviously I can't at the moment, but if I did, what would I see? What would you want to show me?
I think if you showed up in the week, you would see a functioning farm and conservation site. Right at the moment, you would see what looks like the Serengeti, the hardly a drop of water anywhere, and sort of bleached grass all over the place. But you would see a land that has been really recaptured for conservation management. It was kind of left wild for about 20 or 30 years. And so you would see just an extraordinary array of wild flowers and wild animals, and I think that's breathtaking, really, at all different types of the year. So before anything, you would suddenly realize, oh gosh, the land is more important than anything else here. That's super important. And I think you would probably see on many days of the week small groups of people meeting, talking, praying, sometimes working on the farm, but also carrying out other activities from the farm. So I think the digital era has really opened up the possibility of doing podcast interviews, for example, or radio, or Zoom calls with people much further flung around the world, but doing it from a place of personal sanctuary as well, and a place of peace. On a Sunday or Saturdays, it could be very different depending on the time of year and the weather. would make a huge difference. And so we are, in that sense, really do embrace the Celtic element. We have a very vibrant Romanian community who meet and worship at the farm a lot, several hundred of them meeting on a Sunday. We have smaller groups meeting as well at different times during the day on Sunday. So depending on time of day, you might see 40 or 50 people or a few hundred. But they would probably be from two or three different communities and congregations, and sometimes a big family activity day or a conservation day on a Saturday that could have many, many hundreds of people there. Or sometimes it will just feel very, very quiet and peaceful with not a huge amount of people there. So it does very, very varied depending on the time of the year. And, you know, you would see people meeting in little prayer huts in ones and twos. You would see artists in residence. You would sometimes see a psychologist working there. You would see people coming often just to walk and talk rather than a kind of client provider attitude. Mm. If I'm there, very often people are wanting to meet up and talk and share their thoughts and their concerns or what's going on in their lives. And that's often church leaders as well. Mm-hmm. And then I will often be up there doing lectures and live lecturing for my university, but I often do it from the site rather than doing it in person. So distance learning becomes really important. So you might see a group of homeschooling children. Yeah, yeah. You might see groups of people under the trees. It will look very, very varied, but I think the major thing will be that the land is the thing that impacts you the most. And there are a few restored buildings and some tents and a ruined set of buildings as well. So all of that. I don't think it would necessarily come across as hugely impressive. You won't see, a brand spanking new multi-million pound building shining in the sun. You won't see that.
Not yet.
And you won't see it. No, and you won't see, you know, a big spire with a cross on it or anything like that that you might imagine when you think the word Minster. So those are two things you wouldn't see.
Yeah, yeah. You said prayer huts. Tell me more.
We've got a couple of huts that we've put up that are just kept open for people to pray in and seek God in. And they're just left open for people if they're coming up to pray. And we have a prayer walk as well, where people, it's about 25 minutes, that is a guided prayer walk. So you can come up to go for a walk and then follow scripture verses and art installations and pieces of poetry and wind your way around some of the farm and get to see things that you wouldn't have seen before. These little sort of monastic cells really are prayer huts. They have a sofa and a little chairs and everything in them as well as a desk for you to work at or pray or write or journal. And we've got a couple of those dotted around as well.
Wow. So Sunday morning service then, as a vicar. How different is it from a traditional service?
I would say it slightly depends as to when. So over the last 10 years or so, it could have been just sort of 40 people meeting in a barn. For a few years, it was about 400 people meeting in a big yellow tent first thing in the morning, Sunday morning. At the moment, it would be in the Sunday morning, it would be a much smaller group of people, probably meeting outside in the woods or in the barn, depending on the weathers. And then the afternoon would be a normal, larger service, and that would actually be in Romanian. So in terms of the services itself, I think the thing we've done most in the last couple of years, because we've planted out a main congregation that was meeting on a Sunday morning, was planted out just before lockdown. So really given space to explore church outside and church in the forest. So during lockdown, we were able to do that, which was absolutely thrilling. The simplicity of sitting around a small fire in October, praying and worshipping and maybe just a guitar, but studying the scriptures together without the kind of, I think, without the signals of authority that you sometimes feel by being in the front pew of the front pew of a beautiful building.
Yeah, yeah.
I think again, I think that sense of variety and informality and welcome. We have a children's playground, and you know, people are coming and going, and people are free to walk out and walk back in again without everybody craning their heads around to see what's going on. So I think that feels quite important, that you could stroll in and out. And for a number of years, people who felt like church was, they were intrigued and really wanted to come back to regular worship, but for one reason or other found it too difficult. And so we just said to them, well, just sit outside and listen in if you want to. And so there's always been a group of people who are happy to just sit outside their tent flaps having a listen, you know, and wandering and holding on to their dog and just feeling like they can opt in rather than feeling like they are trapped inside church. And it's kind of a festival feel, probably. I think sometimes a summer festival, like a, I don't know, Soul Survivor or Greenbelt, it's much smaller, but that sense you can come in and out of a tent really however, whenever you feel like it, and there are no sort of pews or anything, really suits some people. And for others, you know, actually coming to an old and sacred place with the pews all set up and an altar and the paintings around the walls and everything. I mean, I also enjoy that as well. But, you know, it's that sense of being very, very open to the elements when we come to meet together for worship doesn't suit everyone at all. But for some people, it's just what they need.
Well, I'm building up a big picture in my mind as you talk about this. And I'm thinking, especially after lockdown, and you know, this podcast is called Off-Grid Christianity. What have you seen, especially with the villages around you, do you think, of people saying, look, I still believe in God, but you know, I don't really want to go to church anymore. I'm fed up with the structure in there, being stabbed in the back or whatever. What's your feeling on that? And how can we encourage people to, you know, get back in touch with God?
I think the first thing to ask is, well, what can you imagine enjoying? I think if we've had a bad experience or we're feeling quite estranged, the things in closest in our mind are what things we find difficult. And we just feel so worried that something difficult will happen again, that we're worried to sort of go back. And so I think I'd start with it the other way around. And that's one of the reasons why I've created this prayer walk, really, is to say, well, you know, how do you feel about maybe going for a walk, and you can chat and tell me about what's going on, and we can maybe pray together as we do it. And a lot of people who are not members of churches during lockdown, about half the people who came did our prayer walk, just they knew they were welcome and invited, and they just did their own business with God. So I think that's the first thing that I would try to build on, is just say, well, what would you enjoy? You know, that, you know, you instinctively maybe believe that God is there and that you'd like to get to know him. So can I accompany you, if you like? You know, is there anything I can do to just help you in your own spiritual walk? Rather than signing somebody up on the dotted line day one and say, you know, tithe here.
Leave your credit cards here.
I think that would be the first thing. And then I think just that a culture of invitation that says, well, this is what we're doing and this is what we enjoy. And if you want to come along and join in with us, you're very welcome. If you want to come back again, of course, we'd love to see you again. But I think just that sense of you are genuinely warmly invited and welcome. But it's also fine if you want to just pop in and out and just soak it up for a bit and then come back a little bit later. I think that's really important as people begin to build up the relationship with God. I think the third thing is just encourage people in even groups of three or four to read the Bible together, not just on their own, but to have a chance, almost like a book club. What does it look like when you just actually read the Bible together and maybe have some food together and start to rebuild the kind of inner pieces of your Christian faith and build up to Sunday church, if that makes sense, or build up to feeling like full congregational church life is fine. But, you know, definitely don't, you know, seek out friends and others. Build on what you feel like does really meet where you're at the moment. And then try opening the scriptures with a few people and just seeing when you read those scriptures together, what God starts to bring to mind and bring to light. So we do that with small Bible studies called Discover, an app that we use actually that just asks three or four simple questions of any Bible passage, and we encourage people to meet in those small groups wherever they are. And that's been wonderful, particularly during lockdown, is they don't all have to be in person.
Mm.
It's amazing what you can do just with an hour on a call to with other people. And I think that's been really meaningful. And then I'd say, you know, sometimes it is really important to chase down a real encounter with God. So people are starting to pick up ideas of pilgrimage again, or coming to spend a day in a sacred place, and just start to build your own faith back up again, bit by bit. If you have a local church that you love, rock up, you know, see who else is out there, realize that you're not alone. You know, and I think there's a way of being the body of Christ that suits all of us, really.
Yeah.
And I think, just follow those threads, build on the things that you do love. Do you know what I mean?
I get that entirely.
Flee the things that you hate.
And I get that entirely. And, you know, the remaining, before we do your Christian hero in the remaining couple of minutes, yet again, I'm thinking what you're doing actually, hopefully the churches and various denominations around Latimer Minster are realizing now that actually you're not a threat, you're an opportunity, you know, and that, you know, there are strengths there. And the fact that the bishop within the Anglican Church, you know, is supporting you on this, I'd like to think now that having been in it for 10 years, you know, the traditional, say, C of E churches in your area are saying, no, we can embrace this. You know, you're not a threat to us. You're not working against us. You know, we can come to you as well. Or have I got it wrong?
I mean, that's definitely where we're at the moment. We have very good relationships with the local churches, and Anglican and otherwise. We meet and pray together often as pastors, and I count them as friends, the pastors of those other churches too. So, you know, we've really, sometimes you just walk together for a while, don't you?
Yeah.
When you have a shared love for God's people, a shared love for God, and a shared love for the local community.
Well, it's called communication as well.
Quite often.
It? You know, you're talking with other people.
No, I think that's really, really valuable. And I think I'm looking forward to seeing what the Lord is going to do in these next few years. I mean, lockdown has been so weird for most people, and particularly for churches. I think we're only just beginning to emerge, realizing what has changed positively and what has changed maybe negatively. And there's a lot of church communities and a lot of Christian pastors and leaders who have found these last few years very, very challenging indeed.
Yeah.
And I think I'm seeing a new humility and a new honesty amongst church leaders up and down the country who are saying, actually, you know, I could really do with some help, or, you know, there's a lot more honesty going on in meetings when Christians gather together, whether that be at the festivals over the summer, which have just happened, or in one-to-one conversations. And I think that's really positive, a kind of vulnerability and humility around church life could breed a more of a hunger for God, and potentially more of a tenderer approach to God's people and pastoral care, I think is definitely being called for.
Well,
even if church numbers or congregation numbers might be less, I think there's an amazing opportunity here
to
build tenderer, kinder communities rather than necessarily bigger.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're running out of time. I know we've got to the hero slot, but I think it's only fair that people who are listening today, like me, must probably been building up a picture in their mind saying, oh, I'd really like to go there. This sounds right up my street. Or maybe they want to know more information. Maybe, you know, someone has a patch of land, is a farmer, thinking, I want to make my own Minster. How can they get in touch with you, good sir?
Have a little look at the website, theminster.org. If you want to pop into one of our early morning sort of chapel services, they're 9:30 to 10. 45, and those will be starting up again in September. We've had a pause on them for a while. And particularly if you've got a patch of ground and others, there's a little group of people in similar situations that are starting to bubble up. And so drop me an email, and the details of which are on the website, but it's rector@latimerminster.org, and we'll see we'll see if there's anything we can do to help or encourage or advise or even just say, don't make the mistakes we made. Here's a few pitfalls to avoid. Sometimes jokingly say, you know, when we share our experiences, we're not forcing the Holy Spirit to do the work twice. Of course, the Holy Spirit can do the work as many times as he wants. But I think there is something about realizing that we can share the joys and the sorrows of whatever we've walked before God. And that actually when new people are starting to do something that feels similar-ish, at least in intention, I think these ideas are brewing a bit more often around the country now. I think 10 years ago, I think we did feel slightly out of sync. But now I think barely 2 or 3 weeks goes by before somebody drops me a line and says that they've got this idea. And what would I advise? So, brilliant. Yeah, I think we're potentially going to have a little community of people who are exploring that, maybe with a Zoom call once every couple of weeks, starting later on this year. So you can drop me a line, and if people want to just explore things together, that would be great. And I'm doing a lot of that with the team from Arosha, the Christian Conservation Charity, who've been wonderfully supportive to me in that. So there are networks of people who are having these discussions at the moment. We're not the only ones by any means.
Well, that's fantastic. Frog, it's been a sheer delight listening to you. Thank you so much for what you've shared. And if you want to drop us a line as well, maybe you have some questions, please use our email address, which is OGC. That's OGC at accessradio.biz. And biz is spelled B-I-Z. This has been a BCSC production. Frog, would you please, in the remaining 2 minutes, tell us who your Christian hero is, a bit about his life or her life, when they were born, etc., etc. And thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. Well, I'd love to tell you about Hudson Taylor, who was a pioneer missionary to China in the mid to late 1800s. He's my hero because he really unlocked a way of letting people reimagine church life and mission and ministry around the world, and opened up the inland of China to the sharing of the gospel. He was not a particularly successful guy working in a pharmacy in Barnsley in the north of England, and God got hold of him and gave him this deep call. And after a few years as a missionary, he came back. He had he'd fallen and hurt his back and was lying in bed. And then just suddenly this idea of what if the gospel was to start to spread around the inland of China, not just around the coastal areas. And so began a kind of an era of mission, which is directly responsible for tens of millions of Christians in China today, who first heard the gospel through him, and a bunch of people who heard the call and went, not even knowing if they had a salary or whether they were going to survive at the other end. So, yeah, Chinese Inland Mission and Hudson Taylor, give him a read, be inspired.
Brilliant. And of course, the thing about Hudson Taylor is, with regard to my own personal hero, a chap called George Müller, we always associate him with Bristol, although he was originally from Germany. He was one of the main benefactors, if I remember rightly, with Hudson Taylor. You see, he had a chap who was a missionary himself in Bristol, and he was supporting Hudson Taylor as well. Fantastic. Frog or Ewing, thank you so much for joining us. Let's go. You go.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the interview.
I thought you were going to say you were reading a book there, and I'll let you. You got 30 seconds.
I was just saying one of my ancestors, Archibald or Ewing, heard the call and joined him. So the missionary element in our family began as a response to Hudson Taylor's ministry.
That's fantastic. I'm glad I asked. Thank you, Frog. We'll speak to you again. Thank you so much, sir.